Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Additional support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the center. The National Humanities Center is an independent, nonprofit institute that encourages excellence in scholarship and affirms the importance of the humanities in American life.
I think that there is very little truth about South Africa, both from the left and the right. Those things are there. The exploitation is there. The stratification is there, and that is obvious. But at the same time, in South Africa, wherever you go, you can drink the water.
Every time I'm on the airplane, it's fascinating, you know, because who's sitting next to you? Well, one time it was Parker Toys, because the Monopoly game is going to be translated into the Cyrillic alphabet. Now, that's fascinating to think of marketing Monopoly in the Soviet Union.
What the government wants us to get is exactly the Donald Duck culture or McDonald's culture. In fact, I am not very optimistic, because I think we have the old system collapsing, the old mentality, the old ideology completely collapsing, but there is absolutely no guarantee that something new will be better.
Culture and politics in South Africa, the Soviet Union, and the United States. Two conversations this week on Soundings. First, Harold Marcus of Michigan State University discusses contemporary South African society. Following that, Susan Buck-Morse of Cornell University and Boris Kagarlitsky of the Moscow City Council discuss intellectual cross-currents between the Soviet Union and the United States. Harold Marcus recently visited South Africa to speak to university audiences. He's the author of A Modern History of Ethiopia and of a biography of the Ethiopian leader Haile Selassie. Here is Harold Marcus.
I was struck throughout my exposure to the universities in South Africa with the inability of academics and intellectuals to talk about change in anything but rather hackneyed and trite Marxist and radical terms.
Well, what year are they all living in there?
Well, intellectually, they seem to be living in the 1970s. When I was at the University of Western Cape, I was struck by the fact that this had to be the only university in the world which was still worried about Trotsky, because they were giving a two-day seminar on the dangers of Trotskyite thinking.
All right, now wait. Let me stop you for a moment, Harold Marcus. Does this mean that that we have people who are genuinely living in the past? Is it a shortage of available intellectual vocabulary? How do you figure that mixture out?
The thinking of the ANC cadres and a good many of the young black students and intellectuals is replete with Marxist terminology. Now, I know I'm coming across as reactionary, and I'm not. But the fact of the matter is that they are talking about a radical redistribution of wealth. They are talking about, quote, scientific socialism. They are talking about the eternal truths of Marxism and Leninism.
They're living in the 19th century.
Right. And it doesn't seem to...
Is that bad?
Well... the failures of Eastern Europe and the failures of Marxist regimes in Africa, Ethiopia being the prime example, but nearby Mozambique and Angola, don't seem to influence them at all in their thinking. There is a feeling that somehow or other they will be able themselves to establish a socialist state, and they will be able creatively to accomplish their goals. Now, there is a need in South Africa for a redistribution of some of the national wealth. There is a tremendous black housing shortage, and that can only be satisfied by either A, the government building lots and lots of houses, or B, permitting blacks to move into the to white and colored residential areas, which I suspect is what is ultimately going to happen. There is a need to pour billions of rand into black secondary and higher education. I suspect that's going to be relatively easy to do. But there is a need to integrate the millions of people in the black and colored and Asian middle class into the political structure.
All right, now what does all that have to do with, what shall we call it, an intellectual framework or the basis for an intellectual response? You started our conversation characterizing students and university types in South Africa as at variance in their language with the social reality.
Absolutely. What it basically means is the government will have to move, if it wishes to retain a capitalist structure, if it wishes to relate to the world economy as South Africa has always related to the world economy, it's going to have to integrate millions and millions of blacks into the political structure. And that there is at this time a dysfunction between the black middle classes and its political strength.
Is Nelson Mandela, let me ask you to think about this one particular leader, Harold Marcus. Is Nelson Mandela a social leader, an intellectual leader? Does it make any difference that there is a distinction between the two?
In South Africa, there's tremendous confusion about Nelson Mandela.
You mean who he is?
He certainly is a political icon. There is no question about it, and people wander around wearing T-shirts with Nelson Mandela on it. The fact is that the younger people tend to be more radical in their approach to South Africa's problems than people like Nelson Mandela and Walter Sisulu and others, who have been tempered by years in jail and also by years of experience watching the disasters occur in Africa in so-called socialist or Marxist regimes.
And why is this? Because these individuals understand a history that the younger people do not?
I think a lot of it has to do with the way the South African population is structured. The vast majority of people in South Africa are young, particularly among the African population.
Should we deny them a revolutionary spirit because of their youth?
I think in light of what happened in the United States and elsewhere in the world, yes.
You make me think about a character in a Saul Bellow novel, an old man who says these young radicals haven't earned their passion yet.
Well, the difficulty in South Africa is you're not dealing with a third world environment. You're dealing with a complex first world country with a very developed infrastructure. The country is amazingly prosperous. The violent South Africa of the television screen certainly was not replicated in any of the situations in which I found myself.
Surely you're not calling into question our crack American journalists and their reportage, are you?
I think that they tend to see what they want to see. But I was in Crossroads, I was in Soweto, I was in a number of townships, and indeed, there were people there who were living their lives. I'm sure that from time to time there is violence, just as you can find violence elsewhere. And I have no candle for South Africa or the South African whites, whom I find really quite reactionary in their views and even close-minded and bigoted and everything you want to call them. But if there is to be a new South Africa, it must be a functional South Africa, and a functional South Africa must benefit from the experience of what has happened in Eastern Europe and what has happened in Africa north of South Africa.
All right, now before our taping session for Soundings, Harold Marcus, you told me that the term middle class, that's an old one for you historians and the political theorists, but it's a very, very crucial one here as we understand what's going on in South Africa today. What do you mean by that?
There is today present in South Africa thousands upon thousands of black high school graduates and thousands of black university graduates who over the next 5 years, 10 years, will be added to in a most significant way. These people make the equivalent of 10 to 25, 30,000 American dollars each year. They are consumers, and they are bureaucrats, they are middle management, they are in the shops, they are in the hotels. They represent a significant and a growing population in South Africa. They represent a middle class, not a working class. Now, there is another factor in South Africa, and it's one that people do not talk about very much, although it is on the minds of some, and that is in the 1840s, South African ethnic history or tribal history was stopped dead by the intervention of the Afrikaner, the white persons. Now, as South Africa moves toward a changed political situation, some of these ethnic rivalries are bound to reemerge. We're already seeing examples of that in some of the townships around in Natal province, around Pietermaritzburg.
One of my colleagues pointed out that this is analogous to what's going on in Eastern Europe and the ethnic conflict that exists in the Soviet Union.
Yes, and that is probably why the white persons in South Africa will survive, because they represent an important balance, an important swing, as do the Asians and the coloreds.
A line of authority.
Well, not so much a line of authority, but they can remain either above an ethnic fray if they don't join into it, or they can be a balancer. At the one hand, it's an opportunity for them. On the other hand, it's extremely dangerous for the white community. Mm-hmm.
You said a moment ago that South Africa is not the third world, that it is clearly a first world nation. My sense is that the perception nevertheless remains that South Africa is other. It is antiquated. It is the third world. Explain this to me.
Well, I can give you some examples, but one example that will be understood by Africanists and others is if you go to Africa, north of South Africa, and you're out on a picnic and you leave behind cans and bottles, someone will come and pick it up and recycle it.
Why is that important?
Well, in South Africa, this does not happen. There are cans and bottles all over the place that no one has a need for. It shows that there's a much richer African population than in other places. There are more hospitals, there are more schools, there are more clinics, there are more roads. But South Africa, as such, is a developed country, even in the homeland areas where I happen to be. I happen to travel in Venda in the Eastern Transvaal. And that's a lot better than most areas of Africa with which I'm familiar. It certainly is incredibly far better than Ethiopia, which is a basket case. And that's a country I've studied for over a quarter of a century.
Is there a single change? Is there a single sort of shift that strikes you over the past year or two in contrast to the foregoing years?
Yes, in line with what is going on in the rest of the world, an abandonment of rigid Stalinist state forms, both in Ethiopia, Somalia, Mozambique, Angola, and elsewhere, and a general recognition that the only way to solve the South African problem is to cooperate with the present South African government. It certainly was startling during the Namibian independence celebrations that President de Klerk was holding conversations with leaders in Africa who a year or two would never have talked to a white leader of South Africa. Now, that recognition probably stems from the fact that de Klerk and Mandela get along, and Mandela has taken a statesman position on what South Africa must be in the future.
Harold Marcus teaches at Michigan State University. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Harold Marcus is the author of A Modern History of Ethiopia and of a biography of the Ethiopian leader Haile Selassie. Soundings continues now on international cultural crosscurrents. My guests are Susan Buck Morse of Cornell University and Boris Kagarlitsky, a journalist and a member of the Moscow City Council. Susan Buck Morse and Boris Kagarlitsky recently took part in a conference about restructuring the past and inventing the future of Soviet cultural life. Among the issues before the conference were Russian aesthetics, feminism in the Soviet Union, and Soviet Freudianism. The conference was sponsored by Duke University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Princeton University, and the Soros Foundation. Here is Susan Buck Morse.
Well, I mean, for instance, what have you known before about Soviet Freudianism in the 1920s and 30s? That's a story that really hasn't been told.
Uh-huh. Let's pause on that for a moment. What about Freud in the Soviet Union? Talk to me for a couple of minutes.
Well, in fact, it seems he was very much read, and he was translated into Russian. There was a lively discussion among psychiatrists and generally among intellectuals, and that was rooted out rather slowly. And now, of course, it's coming back, not just on a medical level, but also on a philosophic level.
Uh-huh.
It's this kind of forgotten discourse that now is being voiced both there and now here.
Well, I know that in the United States that there has been a tension between what feminist theory and the doctrines, shall we call them doctrines, of Sigmund Freud. Is there an analogy or an echo of that kind of thing in the Soviet Union?
Well, maybe not. I mean, although, for instance, Lacanian psychoanalysis has traveled to Moscow, I'm not sure if the translation was totally without problem. I don't think it's exactly the same discussion that's going on there. But that's what's interesting.
Uh-huh.
We're getting something new. We're getting our own texts being read by Soviets who are coming back to us with a different interpretation and forcing us to reconsider what we have thought we've been saying.
Uh-huh. Boris Kargaletsky, what about in the area of sociology? Are you learning things from the Americans? Are they learning things from you and your colleagues?
I think we were learning a lot from the Americans when we were studying, because sociology came to the Soviet Union as a kind of American expert good. And for some period of time, sociology in the Soviet Union was considered non-science or bourgeois science, so it was just not developed. So, of course, people have to learn a lot from America. But on the other hand, I think, well, now we have to propose something. We can, do some research which is of real interest.
Can you be specific for me? Can you give me a concrete example of what's
going
on?
Okay. Of course, it's very easy because we are studying our own society. And what is now becoming very interesting in Moscow is a kind of, I think, quite natural and necessary mixture of Weberian and Marxian approaches, which are becoming more and more connected, especially in the people who consider themselves on the left. And I think it's very productive.
Let's talk about Marx for a moment. Marxist-Leninist ideology. There's a joke going around that it lives only in the English departments of American universities. Is this true, Boris Kargaletsky?
No, that is not true. Of course, I know that the difference between Poland and America is that the United States still have a communist party.
Uh-huh.
But I think, well, that's not the only difference. And I think that there is a lot of interest in Marxism in the younger generation of Soviet intellectuals. Well, of course, the generation of which is in their 30s and 40s is very frustrated. But on the other hand, that is the in some way the most desperate generation, because on one hand, they've dropped Marxism in any form completely. But on the other hand, they're very much in trouble to adopt new or alternative models of Western thinking.
Mm-hmm.
While the people who are in some way more close to the Western cultural milieu, they are more capable to discuss Western Marxism as well.
Mm-hmm. Susan Buck-Morse, let me be contentious with both you and Boris Kargaletsky for a moment. Suppose I were to say to you that scholarship in the Soviet Union, Boris just used the term Soviet intellectuals, that's a contradiction. That really you always have scholarship in the service of ideology. Does that take things too far?
Oh yes, I think so. The what I just marvel at when I hear the talks from various people at this conference is that there is an intelligentsia, a tradition of having a function in society in Russian culture and Soviet culture, which is rather wonderful. I mean, these the intelligentsia are supposed to be able to speak for the people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, sometimes that has been at the service of the state, sometimes not, but never have they doubted that they have an important social role, whereas we in our universities could be talking Marxism or anything else, and no one seems to care much.
Boris Kargaletsky, do you think the American people are anti-intellectual? Are the Soviet people pro-intellectual? Tell me about the differences there.
Well, you know, I cannot understand the question this way, because there are probably different people anywhere,
mm-hmm.
and different social layers. And as a sociologist, I never can accept the question like people are intellectual or anti-intellectual. It depends on the milieu.
All right, well, make some distinctions for me then.
Well, I think that in some way, of course, there is a feeling that in American society, intellectuals are both very respected and very marginalized. Well, in the Soviet case, it is really, I agree with Susan completely about this specific role of intelligentsia. But on the other hand, you never can judge whether the things intellectuals propose are really good for the people, or they're just good for the intellectuals.
Does Mikhail Gorbachev, Susan Buck-Morse, listen to the intellectuals of the Soviet Union?
I think some intellectuals certainly. He listens to his wife, and she's a philosopher. I don't know exactly whether we're talking whether the intelligentsia would be synonymous with the advisors to Gorbachev. I mean, what again is the envy of my colleagues is that if a book is published in the Soviet Union, it is an academic book. It will have 100,000 copies in the first print.
Mm-hmm. And they actually get read.
Well, they sell out at 100,000 copies. And for us, you know, if we have 1,000 or 3,000 for an academic book, a monograph, it's considered a success.
Well, do we attribute this to the fact that the Soviet people are starved for publication of any sort, or that they really are paying attention to the substance of what these intellectuals are producing?
Well, I think a little bit of both. I don't know exactly how those... certainly there's not much competition. Whatever is printed... it's either that or nothing else. There's not a lot of magazine, you know, the kinds of pop magazines that we have that would take up your reading time. I think the general level of discussion, again, I'm talking about Moscow, which is the only city I know, and the Soviet Union is a very large place.
It's the same thing almost everywhere.
You think so?
Yes, in Siberia, in Irkutsk, in Novosibirsk, and some other places. Mm-hmm. Well, books are read not only in Moscow. And another thing to add about TV, I think it's very interesting to compare American TV with the Soviet one, because a lot of programs in the Soviet TV, in the popular programs, very often are made as if they were made for intellectuals.
That's true.
You see, and that's a big difference.
I don't suppose you could say that about what's on the air Friday and Saturday night in the United States. Boris Kargalitsky, you, in addition to being a member of the Moscow City Council, you are a columnist. You are a journalist. How free do you feel in what you want to say and how you circulate it?
When I write, I feel free. When I publish, I don't feel free.
Tell me why.
Well, because most of the stuff we produce in our news agency, IMA Press, we produce it for the Soviet youth newspapers, and most of the stuff is always banned by the authorities, or also there is a lot of editorial interference on the level of newspapers and so on. On the other hand, well, we can sell what we want abroad, because the government wants everybody to get hard currency. So we are completely free to sell what we want abroad, anything.
Uh-huh.
So, well, we are selling things to, for example, minor Western left-wing newspapers who don't have their own correspondents in Moscow, and who, in fact, also don't want to accept the stories from Reuters or somebody else. So we're doing things for them, and we are very critical about Gorbachev, about the reform policies, and all that is not possible to be published in the Soviet press, but, well, we can freely publish that in the Western press.
Uh-huh. What about the fact that the Soviet Union also has a relationship with Europe, in addition to its relationship with the United States? Boris Kargalitsky?
There is a lot of discussion about Europe now in the Soviet Union, and in fact, on one hand, of course, there is a traditional idea that Americans and Russians must stare at each other and, well, surprisingly find a lot of common things. But on the other hand, we are Europeans because we are part of the European tradition, and also, well, during the conference, there were people from England, there were people from East Germany, probably some other European places. Anyway, and it is not just some, so to speak, Soviet-American business. It is an international thing, and it's very much a European business.
Are we looking to one world, Susan Buck-Morse?
I don't know if one will, but I mean, I don't think, and I think we have to get out of this whole superpower thinking that it's all about U.S., USSR. It isn't. Uh-huh. It's a very different world, and both the Soviet Union and the United States are going to lose a certain dominance because of that, but in the long run, although it will be a difficult time, it will. It's a hopeful time, in my estimation.
Footnote to our conversation, Susan Buck-Morse and Boris Kargalitsky. Boris, what would you say to an American audience? I mean, I don't mean for you to be idiosyncratic, but what would you tell America about where you live and how you live your life? You are, after all, other. You are something very strange to most of our listeners.
We're not so strange, and we are not so different. One of the most striking things about comparing East and West is that the difference is not as big as it is supposed to be. And we are becoming less and less different, but we are becoming different in a different way, because we are becoming more and more a kind of third world country. And that is a great danger, but in some way also a great opportunity, because we're discovering a new world anyway.
Do you feel optimistic about the intellectual cross currents that go on between the United States and the Soviet Union?
Well, you know, I've been involved in this cross current for about 3 years. And when I first started and started learning the language, my older colleagues told me, well, don't bother, because it'll be like Khrushchev's thaw. It'll be short lived, and then the lid will come down, and you will have wasted all that time, and nothing will come of it. I think that's just not possible this time, perhaps because the technology is different. I mean,
you mean satellites, that
no,
sort of stuff?
No, I mean that I can fax something to my friends with whom I work, and when it didn't work over the telex channels to get the visa in time, I telephoned, and I telephoned Pan Am, and they got a ticket on the Moscow side. I mean, there's a kind of way that you can work with the technology to simply go around the edges, and I think that the powers that be need those lines of communication as much as we do.
Susan Buck-Morris teaches at Cornell University. Boris Kargalitsky is a journalist and a member of the Moscow City Council. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Susan Buck-Morris and Boris Kargalitsky recently participated in a conference on restructuring the past and inventing the future of the Soviet Union. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip is 27709. Ask for program number 516. That's program number 516. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, conversations about science and society in 19th century England. My guests will be Nicholas Rupke of the Australian National University and Harriet Ritvo of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. 176 years ago this week, British forces raided Washington, D.C. They burned the Capitol, the President's home, and many public buildings. The invasion lasted 2 days. The third week in August of the year 79 A.D. saw the eruption of Vesuvius, the volcano that destroyed Pompeii. Uruguay declared its independence from Brazil. That was in August of 1825. Birthdays this week include the aviation pioneer Orville Wright, the journalist Edgar Guest, the horror story writer H.P. Lovecraft, the Chilean leader, Bernardo O'Higgins, the poet, Edgar Lee Masters, the American president, Benjamin Harrison, the cartoonist, Walt Kelly, the architect, Eliel Saarinen, and the Indian leader, Rajiv Gandhi. Finally, this week marks the anniversary of the founding of the American Bar Association. That was in mid-August of 1878. It also marks the anniversary of the first man-powered flight in 1977 and of the birth of Archibald M. Willard. Willard is known for his painting, The Spirit of 76. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Additional support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation. Reshaping politics and culture in South Africa and the Soviet Union, this week on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Harold Marcus of Michigan State University discusses intellectual currents in contemporary South Africa. Susan Buck-Morris of Cornell University and Boris Kargalitsky of the Moscow City Council discuss restructuring the past and inventing the future of Soviet culture. Intellectual cross currents, East, West, and South, this week on Soundings.